In remarriage of Balci, case number 2007 CA 1962. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes. The clock indicates how much time you have remaining. The yellow light comes on when you have 5 minutes. You can retain appellant. You can retain whatever time you want for rebuttal. Please make sure your cell phones are off. You may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Dan West. I represent the respondent appellant in this matter, Victoria Garber. As I did in my brief, I will refer to her today in this argument as mother, and I will refer to the petitioner appellee as the father. My client is asking that this court reverse the trial court's order of August 24, 2007, in which the court appointed the father the primary residential custodian of the child, and specifically she argues that the trial court applied the inappropriate standard. Specifically, she argues the trial court should have applied the so-called endangerment statute found at CRS 14-10-129, subparagraph 2.
Excuse me,
yes.
Counsel.
Mm-hmm.
I understand your argument regarding the court applying the wrong standard, the endangerment standard versus the best interest standard.
Correct.
We have a rule, CAR 28K, which requires that you let us know where you preserved that claim and where the court ruled on it below. I don't see that in your brief. Can you tell us where you preserved
the claim
that you're now making?
Certainly.
On appeal?
I don't believe that. I understand that rule, and I understand that you have to designate where it was preserved. But I don't think it was ever even addressed. When the trial court entered its order in September 27, 2005, it very clearly said it was a temporary order. So they go and have their orders, they go and have their permanent orders hearing, and the trial court applies the best interest of the child standard and not the endangerment standard. I don't know when that would have been addressed other than after the court ruled. And I don't think it was required that they file the motion to reconsider before the trial court before seeking relief to this court. So I believe that, and I've always looked at that rule as more of an evidentiary presentation. I don't believe that it was required to be presented. In other words, the hearing gets set for a permanent orders hearing, that the appellant was required to say, oh, and by the way, the endangerment standard applies. And that's just my position. And I noticed that appealee doesn't argue that in his brief, but I appreciate the question and I understand the position of the court.
Well, Mr. West, I have a question about that also.
Okay.
Interestingly, I went and read the transcripts of the hearing, the latter hearings on this case, after what you're referring to as the temporary order. And interestingly, Mother's counsel argued the flip side of that, which is that the child would be endangered if the child were to remain in father's care, not the other way around. So apparently, the assumption was by mother's counsel that an endangerment standard would have to be shown in order to remove the child from father's custody. Can you please address that?
Well, and I know exactly what you're referring to, and I don't think that simply by saying that, gee, I think there's an endangerment here is somehow proof that mother thought it was an endangerment standard, and therefore the previous order of the court on 9-27-05 was a permanent order. I think what counsel was trying to say at that hearing is not only have we met the best interest of the child standard here, but and frankly, it's father's motion to modify. If we go all the way back, it's essentially father's motion to modify. The mother is simply defending that motion under my analysis of the case, because this is just a continuation of the temporary orders, and mother is defending that motion and is saying not only is it in the best interest of the child that the child stays with mother, but it also would be endangered if this child was to remain with father under this temporary order.
Well, but help us out here, Mr. West, because this is a very unusual set of facts.
I could not agree more with you on that one.
3 years approximately had gone by after what you're referring to as a temporary order, with the child living in father's house all that time. Why wasn't it incumbent upon mother to tell the court you have to apply an endangerment standard, and you have to apply an endangerment standard with respect to whether custody should be taken away from mother? So that's one part of the question, but the other part is, even if the court were to make the endangerment ruling that you're now saying it should have made, as of what date would it have been applicable? What was the danger that the court should have found? Or if we were to remand, what's the court supposed to do?
And I absolutely was thinking about that same thing today. Here's what happens, is the court holds this hearing on September 27th, 2005. And at that hearing, the court does make an endangerment finding, but then tells the parties that this is a temporary order. And this is a temporary order, and we're going to reset it for permanent orders at the end of the school year to take a look at this. Now, what happens is they do have a hearing, and they have a hearing in August of that year.
They have a bunch of hearings, and years go by.
And at the end of each hearing, the judge says, well, I don't have enough information still. Mm-hmm. And she says that over and over and over. Now, does the trial judge, I hope this is responsive to your question, does the trial judge, by saying, well, gee, I don't have enough information, somehow turn that September 27, 2005 order into a permanent order by continuing the hearing and continuing the hearing? And I think, and I hope that's responsive, but I think an important point is, and I think the most important point that I can make here today, is that the September 27th, 2005 hearing, where the court says this is a temporary order and we're going to have a permanent order hearing at the end of the school year, if my client had appealed that order, this court would have dismissed that appeal because for lack of a final judgment. And I think that's an important issue, because and I think the court should have, because the court told the parties that this is a temporary order and set it for a permanent orders hearing. And if that was not an appealable order, it wasn't a final order. And it wasn't a final order until ultimately August 24th, 2007 order was issued. I agree with you completely, Judge Terry. I think this is the most confusing procedural case that I've ever seen. But at the same time, we have to worry about mother's rights and mother's appellate rights. And mother's appellate rights, if you adopt father's argument that the September 27th, 2005 order was permanent, basically you usurped her right to appeal that decision.
Well, but if you win, Mr. West, what do you get? What do we tell the trial court to do? And as of what date is she supposed to, or is the trial court supposed to make an endangerment determination?
I think, and that was the second part
of
the question.
As of now or as of?
No, I think that the issue has to go back. Remember, the last hearing, the court makes the finding that either parent would be just fine. And that's why it's clear that it was applying a best interest of the child standard. So I think you can do one of two things. I think you can reverse the trial court's August 24th, 2007 order and said, listen, you didn't apply the appropriate standard, and your findings in and of themselves say that either party would be fine. And so then we go to the last permanent order, which in my argument would be the order that was entered on January 12, 2005, and that was after a mom had filed a motion to modify some parenting time, and the court entered a new parenting time schedule and addressed a decision make or an issue with regard to a four-wheeler.
Well, but you lost me, though, because what you're saying is the trial court didn't make a necessary finding based on the correct standard.
Right.
So if you win, theoretically, we send it back to the trial court and say, tell us whether the child was endangered or is endangered, but as of what date. There is, as I see it, at least three possibilities. It could be the date of the remand.
Right.
There could be the date of the original, what you're calling the temporary order, or there could be the date of what some would say that was the final order of the August 2007 order. But the point is that if it's the date of what you're calling the temporary order, that finding was already made. But the other problem that I'm having, and I apologize, I'm throwing a couple of different questions out here, but the other problem that I'm having is how is the court, if it's any date other than the November 5 order, the November 05 order,
right?
Why would the child have been endangered? The child was out of danger, theoretically, by having been taken out of mother's custody at that point.
And I'll try to answer all those questions.
I apologize for tossing them all, but this is what I'm struggling with.
No, and I appreciate the question, and it's things that I've thought about. I think, to answer the first part of your question, I think if you decide that the court should have applied the endangerment standard at the August 24th, 2007 hearing, you remand it back. There's only one motion here that I know of, and that's the motion that that father made back in 05 to change who the primary custodian was. And so you remand it back, and the court can either have further proceedings and determine whether there's endangerment on the date of that hearing or that there's not. The second part of your question is, well, at the temporary orders hearing, the court did find that there was endangerment, and that's well taken. But you have to remember that under 1410.129, a temporary order is not even a parenting time order. And that I cited the Fickling case, In Re Marriage of Fickling, and In Re Marriage of Henn, H-E-N-N-E, for that proposition. So I don't think it makes a difference that she found endangerment at the time of the temporary orders hearing. I think you can do, again, one of two things. You can say, based on your own findings, that this child is not endangered in either party's household, so we go back to the last permanent orders hearing, or the last permanent order that was issued. Or you can say, we're remanding it back, and you need to apply the endangerment standard, and you should apply it and make a finding on what is the current circumstance at the day of the hearing. And I think that's what 1410.129 would provide. I don't think it specifically says that,
So do I understand correctly, then, that your position would be that if we remanded, we would say to the court, make a determination as to whether the child's well-being is being significantly impaired. I think that's the basis here.
Right.
Significantly impaired if she were to be with mother on the date of your hearing.
Correct. I think that's right, because I think my position is the only permanent order that is at issue here is the last one before father filed his motion. And so, I think you can do one of two things. You can just reverse and not remand because the judge already made the finding that there was no endangerment or impairment of emotional development, or you can say it should have been applied and let's go back to the data hearing. Was that responsive to you, Judge?
Yes, go ahead. Okay.
Again, I think the issue here is the procedural fairness. And if you cannot determine, I don't see how mother would have determined that September 27, 2005 order was a final order. This is an order that takes the child out of her care and puts it into father's care. The court told her this is a temporary order. The court also told her that we're going to review this at the end of the school year, which was only a few months away. And now we get, even though we called it a temporary order, we're going to treat it as a permanent order. That effectively prevented her from appealing that order, which is a big deal. Basically took the child out of her care. The Murphy, I just want to talk about the Murphy case, and I'll reserve the rest of my time. And the Murphy case that was cited by the father in his brief, and I would admit that under the Murphy case, it's not what the court calls the order, but it's really the substance of the order. And the Murphy court relied on three things in that case. And specifically, the Murphy order was for an indefinite duration. The second thing was the Murphy decision in the Murphy parenting time order, there was no provision for judicial review or modification. And finally, apart from its designation as a temporary order, it was otherwise indistinguishable from a permanent order. I don't think any of those factors are present here because, again, I think it's the September 27, 2005 order that's really at issue, whether that was permanent or whether that was temporary. And this was not for an indefinite duration. It was for a finite duration. Even though procedurally it ended up going on for a couple of years, the court didn't enter it as an order in that respect. It said, come back, and they in fact did come back August of that year. So it was for a finite duration. It certainly had an express provision for review and modification when the trial judge told the parties, we're going to set this for a permanent orders hearing, and we're going to go from there. I don't see how it can be said that it's indistinguishable from a permanent order when it's called a temporary order and provides for review, and in fact was reviewed, and ultimately wasn't finally decided until August 24th of 2007, and therefore that's why we're here before you today. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. West.
Good afternoon. I'm Rocco McConey, bar registration number 5164 from Canyon City. Canyon City, of course, is the garden spot of Colorado. I have the honor of representing the petitioner father appellee in this particular case. The respondent mother essentially brings two reasons why this court should reverse the trial court's order, and I do not believe that either of those are appropriate in this particular case. The first is that the respondent suggests that the court is deprived of subject matter jurisdiction because the respondent, the petitioner father did not submit an affidavit as required by 1410.131. There are two problems that I see with this issue. The first is I find no case authority, and the respondent mother cited none, that suggests that a failure to comply with that, if indeed it was applicable, deprives the court of subject matter jurisdiction. Now, to me, that's a fairly critical but very interesting, because I think it's may make it a matter of first impression before this particular court, but I don't think we'll ever get there. I think about a case that I have in Canyon City currently where a father kicked a child who was a toddler in the head with such severity that it crushed the child's brain, skull, causing the child now to be virtually blind, unable to function on one side of its body, and certainly with brain damage. Now, if those parties had had a hearing within 2 years and father had prevailed, and if mother now files a motion for change in custody, sets all this out with pictures, police reports, medical records, under the theory of the respondent in this case, the court would look at the woman and say, I'm sorry, but you didn't file an affidavit, so I have no authority, I have no jurisdiction to hear your case. That doesn't make sense to me. I would hate to think that's, in fact, what our process is. So if we do not have the theory of subject matter jurisdiction, if it does not deprive the court of subject matter jurisdiction, what is the penalty for failure to comply with that provision of the statute, because the statute is clearly mandatory? And I would suggest a couple of things. One is, if you look at Murphy and some of those other cases, they talk about a standard of what they call gross, gross abuse of discretion. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. Or maybe it is one of those provisions in the statute for which there is no punishment. Certainly we have other provisions in the statute that are mandatory, but there's no penalty for violation of the same. It's essentially mandatory but also directory to the trial court in the administration of their courts in their own jurisdictions. Now, in this case, however, I don't think we'll ever reach that point, because the statute is not applicable to this case. Now, the trial court was confronted with a motion to dismiss for failure to comply with that provision, and the court found, and there's substantial evidence in the file to support the proposition, that it was never raised. The mother's motion that she filed back in 2004 did not seek a change in parental responsibilities, and the court said it was never raised by the mother during the course of the proceeding in 2004. So the judge said there is no authority here. I mean, it just didn't occur, and therefore it isn't applicable to this case. Now, the judge mentioned there were some minor issues that were decided in that 2004 motion, but that follows current standard law, which suggests that when a change sought is purely quantitative and one of relatively limited magnitude, then you do not apply the endangerment statute provisions. And if you don't do that, then the best interest standards are applicable. 2-year bar is not applicable in that case. The court made specific findings that it was not applicable. It's supported by the record in this particular case. The mother did not raise those issues. In fact, it'd be kind of a more interesting issue. What happened if the judge had found favor with that argument? And then the father appeals, saying there was never any decision, there was never any motion filed that put parenting time in issue, there was never any determination or evidence presented at the hearing. How can you do this? And you're limited to what the respondent is saying to this court in her brief, which is, well, you have to understand that the respondent mother implicitly requested a modification. Boy, that's a hard sell. I think I would have a hard time selling that to this court. It just didn't occur at the trial court level, and that is, and therefore the court was never deprived of subject matter jurisdiction. The more interesting case, or the more interesting issue, is the suggestion that there is a wrong standard used, and that the court used the best interest as opposed to the endangerment standard. This also fails for two reasons. The first is it was in fact a final order. Now, counsel has said to this court several times in argument that there was going to be another hearing at the end of the school year, and so this was just temporary. And I would beg to differ, and I'm going to beg to differ by reading exactly what the court said in its order. The court said, "The court is setting forth this order as a temporary order for leave by either party to bring back the same to the court by the end of the school year if revisions and/or modifications are necessary." It did not require another hearing. It did not set another hearing. It did not demand another hearing. The court merely said, if you're going to continue, if you have other information or evidence you want this court to understand, because I really don't see, there's a lot of stuff here that I'm missing, I will authorize you to do that.
Well, Mr. McConey, didn't in fact Mother move pretty quickly within a month or two to try to get another hearing before the court?
There were several requirements that the court had imposed or suggested to be done, including therapy and those things. She did some of those things. Both the parties did some and not others as well. I can't answer your question as to how specifically or how quickly she moved because I wasn't the attorney at the trial court level, so I don't know how soon she asked for that. But clearly she did ask for a hearing, and she asked for a hearing fairly shortly. But that doesn't change or alter the fact that the court in its order did not require the same. The judge said, fine. Now, I would ask this. What if nobody asked for another hearing? What if tempers calmed down and things kind of got mellow and nobody asked for another hearing? Does that mean we have a temporary support hearing order for years until the child emancipates? Well, the answer is that's ridiculous. Of course that doesn't work. But it works perfectly if it's a final order, final hearing. Now, what I find significant about that order is the court entered the order and said, I'm going to make a temporary order so that you can bring it back if you think it's necessary. But that's a big if you think it's required. And if not, it's not. Now, I would say that the case law supports that argument as well. I've cited that in there in the brief. An order, whether it's temporary or permanent, is not determined by its label. And we cited the Murphy case and also the CTG case. Whether a child custody order is interlocutory or final is determined from the substance and the effect of the order and not its designation, which is exactly the situation here. The parties didn't need to do anything. It was a final order. In Murphy, which is a case that was cited, when the effect of the order is to be permanent, its designation as temporary experiment is not controlling. And the Murphy court cited an Illinois case, Condos, which I've also cited in the brief. And there's a couple of Illinois cases that seem to be directly on point. Now, in Murphy, the court characterized its order as temporary, but it was for an indefinite duration, which is exactly what the situation was here. And it contained no express provision for further judicial review or modification. Same here. Just said, if you want to bring it back, I will hear it, which I think is keeping a judicial hand on the matter for the purposes of the benefit of the child, but it's not mandatory at all. Apart from the court's designation as a temporary order, the order was otherwise indistinguishable from a permanent custody order. Any decision can be sought to be reviewed or if it can meet the statutory requirement. And I think what the court was doing was saying, I'm not mom, I'm not going to hold you to that standard of having to show that there was, in fact, an endangerment standard as called for in the statute. Although clearly the respondent mother's attorney thought that was the situation at the subsequent hearing that was done in 2007. Now, one of the things that the respondent mother raised in her brief and cited here again today in our argument was, well, you know, if that's a permanent order, then you're depriving the mother of the opportunity to appeal. Well, the answer is no. I think that's the beauty of that order, as convoluted as it is. On the one hand, it's final. I'm changing custody. I'm making the requisite determination of pursuant to the statute. And I think we would all agree that the court did just that, made findings that are consistent with the statute and authorized and warranted it, and the facts that are set forth substantiate the judge's finding. But at the same time, the judge said, I'll be glad to consider this anew or have other information presented to me. And I'm going to call it a temporary order. And therefore, if you bring it back again, you won't have to meet this endangerment test. is what we'll consider to be part of this ongoing process. So the respondent mother says, well, what happens if I tried to appeal? I would be told I couldn't appeal. It would be dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction is not timely. Well, the answer is, of course not. Because we don't, if you looked at that order, it's clearly a final order. The mother could have appealed after the 2005 hearing. She chose not to, but no harm. She brought additional information to the court. The court had several more hearings to determine all of that and didn't change anything. And so I think it was a good order in the sense that it provided that to the respondent mother. Now, the Flichting case, which we both have cited in our briefs, cites a Montana case as well as another case that says that temporary child custody is merely an initial determination made to ascertain which of the parents will keep the children until such time as a full hearing on custody can be heard. This was a full hearing. It was a knockdown, drag-out fight complete with experts, dueling experts. It was not something that was just on a temporary basis. And at the conclusion of that, the court made specific findings in keeping with the statutory scheme and found that there was an endangerment in the mother's circumstances and changed custody. Can't get much more permanent than that. Now, the two cases that the court decided, one was the Condos case, it was Illinois case, which is directly in point. In that case, the court called it temporary, but ordered that the children be with one parent for 1 year and with another child with the other parent for another year. In other words, switch year, which is, one could talk about the appropriateness of that kind of an order. But in any event, the court said this is a temporary order, year in, year out. And the Court of Appeals in Illinois said, oh, no, that's a final orders. That's a final hearing. Even though it was characterized as temporary, you have to look at the circumstances of it itself. There's another case which is even closer, which is the Pratt decision in the brief, in which the court stated that an award of custody was for 1 year and ordered it to be reexamined by the court after the year to see if any changes were necessary. Unlike the case at bar, where the court authorized the parties to once again come back if they chose to do so, in the Pratt case, the court ordered it and said, I want you back here in a year, and it's a temporary order. And the Court of Appeals said, no, it's not. It's a final order. It is a final order subject to appeal. The court said that it appears merely by having been an attempt by the trial court to ensure continued judicial supervision of the issue of custody, and the order could have said, without changing its meaning, that the husband is awarded custody of the child forever. It's exactly the situation here. If this judge, the trial judge, had said, I'm changing custody, but if you want to come back at the end of the school year and present something else, I'll consider that, fine. I think the choice of the word temporary is unfortunate, but it's not dispositive of anything. In fact, if you look at the order itself and the proceedings, it was done. Now, even if, and this is my second reason why I think the argument fails, even if it was intended to be temporary, okay, the court in its 2005 order did in fact set forth those statutory grounds necessary to make a determination and finding that change was necessary. If the 2007 hearing is nothing more than a continuation of the 2005 hearing, and that's what counsel said in his argument, just a continuation of the temporary order, then the court has made, as part of the record in this case, the requisite findings to support it. The court found the evidence in the 2007 hearing to be just unpersuasive to change the court's orders and finding in 2005. That's all that happened. I'm not aware of any law or case authority that says that what the court, when there's a continuance, must regurgitate the findings from a prior or hearing into the new hearing in order for it to be effective when the hearing is on the same issue. I believe that the court's order is appropriate and should be sustained on appeal. Thank you.
Bailiff, would you please add an extra minute on Mr. West's time? We used up some of his time with our own questions.
Thank you, Judge. I want to address a couple of things the counsel had mentioned. And one, I think, as far as the September 27, 2005 hearing goes, I think what you have to look at in determining whether it was temporary order or permanent order is look at the course of proceedings thereafter. And specifically, No motion was ever filed to modify that September 27th, 2005 order. Why? Because it was a temporary order. They were going to set it for a final orders hearing and in fact did. After the September 27th, 2005 order, a parental responsibilities evaluator was appointed. That's what we do in these cases. Divorce is filed. We have the temporary orders. If we don't like the result, we get a parental responsibilities evaluator. So it's very similar to any other temporary order.
Mr. West, as I read the court's 05 order, where it says that it's a temporary order, it says for leave by either party to bring it back by the end of the school year. Is that a condition on the temporariness? That is that a situation where if you don't bring it back by the end of the school year, your leave has expired?
Well, I think that order is a little bit inconsistent with its oral pronouncements at the hearing, and she adopted the oral pronouncements as a part of that same order. And what the oral order says is, so I'd say by the end of the school year, and then at the end of the school year, which implies after the school year, and the parties want to clear a date for permanent orders, and then we can see how it went for the last school year. So that tells me set it at the end of the school year, which it was August. I assume the child got off out in June or so, and the court's docket, you know, that was the, if you notice in the file, there's a number of continuances of that hearing. And part of that is because of the parental responsibilities evaluation that was being conducted. After that September hearing as well, we have psychological evaluations being done. Let me just find my place here.
We have a motion for an evaluator in January of 06.
Correct, but no motion to modify any previous order. That's correct. And then the psychological evaluations took place thereafter. And then there's also hearings in August of 2006 and March of 2007. And at the conclusion of each one of those hearings, the judge says, well, we need to do X, Y, and Z before I'm ready to rule on this. And it just by the way she's handling it, it's clear to me that even after the September hearing, she was not convinced that she had enough information to make a final determination. My time is up, and I appreciate your patience.
Thanks, Mr. West. And thank you, Mr. McConey. This case is now submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both, especially given the unusual procedural posture of this case, assisting us with sorting it all out. That completes our docket for today, so the Division 6 will now stand adjourned.